Met in Edinburgh, joined as always by Frank Cogliano, remote from Charlottesville. How are things there, Frank?
Everything's great today in Charlottesville, David. It's one of my favorite days of the year. It's opening day for the baseball season. So we're born again. There's new grass on the field to quote John Fogerty.
And there's new opportunities for all kinds of things, or more disappointment, depending on what your team is.
Yeah,
Right.
you. Sorry. You have more cause to be optimistic as a Yankee fan than I do as a Red Sox fan
Well,
right now.
that's
Surely,
yes,
you're full of
but
optimism.
at this point the teams are even and the odds may be in one favor and the other. But speaking about odds, well, today we're talking about gambling in baseball, in part because there is a new scandal with who is with the probably the most prominent player, not only in the United States but in the whole world, about gambling. So we're going to talk about the history of baseball and gambling. And for those listeners who are thinking I'm going to tune out this episode, we're going to hopefully not be super inside baseball about this, but actually connect this to some bigger themes in American history, beside what goes on at the baseball diamond. But for Frank, for those people who have not been following the most recent scandal, do you want to give people the sort of the what we know at least now about
Sure. And it's important to qualify this that this isn't an ongoing story. It's also a legal matter, and we've only got limited information. And by we, I mean the world. But what happened is a week or so ago, the baseball season actually opened. There was a two-game series in Seoul, in South Korea, played between the San Diego Padres and Los Angeles Dodgers. And during that two-game set, or as the team on the second day, I think it was reported that one of the that the translator for Shohei Ohtani, and I'll say a bit more about him in a second, the translator for Shohei Ohtani, who's a player from Japan who plays for Los Angeles, had been fired by the team because he had been involved. He racked up massive gambling debts. Now it transpired, and so Ohtani, for listeners who don't know who he is probably one of the most prominent athletes in the world. During the offseason, he signed a contract that might be worth $700 million for the Dodgers. The valuation of that contract is itself a matter of some dispute. It's not relevant to this story, except to say he's the highest paid, most prominent player in the game right now. He's got a massive international following, especially in East Asia as well as in North America. And he's a very, very prominent figure. He's an extremely good player, and he most notably because he pitches as well as bats at a level that we haven't seen before.
Since Babe Ruth,
So
really.
yeah, and so he's a kind of transcendent player in all kinds of ways. Completely unblemished reputation until about a week or 10 days ago, and so this was a bit of shocking news. What seems to be the case is that Ohtani's translator, a guy named Ipe Mitsuhara, was fired by the team, by the Dodgers, once it was revealed that he had paid, I think, $4.5 million of Ohtani's money to a bookmaker in California because he'd been involved in gambling. Now, as the story unfolded, and I want to make clear that we don't have a final version of events yet, but based on what we know, Mitsuhara initially said that Ohtani had given him the money to pay off his gambling debts. Several days later, Ohtani said that wasn't the case, that Mitsuhara had taken the money from him. And Ohtani, a couple days ago, appeared with a new translator and made a statement in which he unequivocally said that he had not bet on baseball or any other sport. The confusion here arises from a number of things. First of all, Ohtani's money was used to pay off this guy's debts. Secondly, the debt was owed to an illegal bookie because sports betting, which is widely legal across the United States and certainly on the internet, is not legal in California. And that distinction is really, really important. Had this happened in Nevada, where gambling is legal, and if Mitsuhara had accrued legal debts, this might not be as problematic as it is. But because sports gambling is illegal in California, that's an important element of the story. And there's confusion about whether Ohtani knew about this or not. And there's a lot of speculation, and I want to emphasize that it's speculation, particularly by fans of teams other than the Dodgers, that Mitsuhara was placing bets for Ohtani, and people have said, well, how could he possibly have, siphoned $4.5 million from Ohtani without Ohtani knowing it? I think one thing we have to bear in mind in all of this is that rich people aren't like the rest of us. Shohei Ohtani made $65 million last year in salary, and that doesn't cover the tens of millions that he makes in endorsements and various other revenue streams.
And he got married over the summer.
He got married over the winter. Yeah.
Winter.
And he got married. His finances are complicated, and the fact that he has people who may be spending money on his behalf or wiring money on his behalf, I don't think is as shocking and remarkable as it would be if it were you or I and somebody were sending money out of our accounts. I don't know whether you've got $65 million, David. So the long and the short of it is this is being investigated. Gambling on baseball is the one thing, as we'll see, that is unforgivable in the rules of the game. And so if it were proved, and we are a million miles from this at this stage, and I want to be clear, Shohei Ohtani has denied this, but if it were proved, for example, that Ohtani had bet on baseball or somebody had bet on baseball on his behalf, it wouldn't matter that he's the biggest star in the game. He'd be out. Now, I don't think that's where we're headed necessarily, but who knows? There is a scenario where that could be the case.
I think the part of the reason why this story has been such a big story, besides the fact that he's the best player in the world right now, and one of the most visible, is because baseball does have this very long history of expelling players for gambling, especially some very high profile players, and having some very very strict rules about gambling, probably stricter so than other sports that one might think.
Should we go back to start reviewing that history?
Because
period, David, your Civil War guys love to bet on baseball.
Oh, to be sure, right? And I think if we go back to the origins of professional baseball, I think it's almost impossible to divorce that from gambling. So professional baseball emerges right after the Civil War, and so does gambling on sports, right? And in fact, the first gambling scandal takes place in 1865. So the same year the Civil War ends, they managed to also have a gambling scandal. And this involves players from the New York Mutuals who were bribed $100 each, which back then was a lot of money, to throw some games against the Eckford Club of Brooklyn. But gambling in the 19th century was a very common pastime. I mean, it was a thing that lots of men did, and it's hard to imagine professional sports, I think, at the time were existed in large part because of gambling. It was not this idea that professional sports existed as sort of a pure form of entertainment. All of the major professional sports that existed in the mid-19th century were fundamentally tied up with gambling, whether that's, the other big professional sports at the time were boxing and horse racing. And those exist in part for entertainment, but mostly so people can bet money on. And I think, looking at baseball, this transition that baseball makes from being an amateur sport of gentlemen, if it ever was that, to being a professional sports is very much tied in with the sort of rise of gambling on baseball. And then there are lots of scandals in the 19th century about people betting on baseball, and baseball tries to push back against that. Because I think that baseball tries to make itself different from, I think, boxing and horse racing in that respect. So the National League has a big gambling scandal in 1877. So the second year of the National League, there were four players for the Louisville Grays who were banned, including a very prominent pitcher. For taking money for throwing games. The interesting thing about a lot of these cases, though, in the 19th century, and I think we'll see this also in the 20th century, is the part of the reason why the players are taking money for throwing games and why gambling is so prominent, is the players are not paid very well, right? You know, and most of the players had side hustles of various kinds in the off season and what have you, you know, and gamblers coming with money is one of the ways in which players are, you know, made a living. But if you were to go to a baseball game in the 19th century, you would have seen gamblers there. You would have seen people changing hands. There's actually a reference. There's the famous poem, Casey at the Bat from 1888. And there's a reference in the poem to gamblers, you know, betting on whether Casey was going to strike out or not. So a bunch of guys lost some money, at least poetic money.
Yeah, I mean, I think your point about how poorly paid the players were is really, really important in all this. And now people can have gambling problems, whether they're rich or poor. We know this. One of the reasons I'm skeptical or I'm reserving judgment on the Ohtani case is Ohtani's been a celebrity since he was in high school. And he's made a lot of money, and his reputation rests, or sorry, his success rests obviously on his ability, but also on his reputation as a as a clean living guy. And he's risking a lot if he were kind of secretly gambling. I'm not saying that's not possible. Of course it's possible, but I'm skeptical about how likely that was. Whereas these guys in the 19th century and the first half of the 20th century, ball players weren't very well paid. I mean, they worked in the off season, as you say, side hustles. A lot of them had to have side hustles. And in the late 19th century, they're very poorly paid and often not being paid. I mean, one of the themes that comes up repeatedly in most of the gambling scandals in the first century of baseball history are owners not paying wages. So not even paying the paltry wages they were committed to, or withholding wages and things like that. And I think that's a factor. The other thing I would say, David, is we just need to acknowledge that 19th century baseball teams had great names. I think we should have the Louisville Grays and the New York Mutuals back in Major League Baseball. I think names like that would be great.
I was hoping when Cleveland renamed their team earlier, or I guess last year, I was very much hoping the Spiders would come back. Although the reason why the Spiders died in the first place, I think, was because the owner owned two teams and sold all the good players from the Spiders to another team. But, you know, so be it. You know, 19th century baseball was pretty corrupt, but I think baseball was trying very much to be a pure sport. So they're doing interesting things to try to sort of clean up the game. So they're doing things like the National League at one point bans alcohol from being sold at games. They stop playing games on Sundays for a while on the supposition maybe that would be, you know, be more moral. You know, they are trying to sort of make baseball into something different from, say, boxing, which is, you know, obviously at this point pretty corrupt and in a variety of ways. You know, and I think you see sort of the rise of sort of the progressive movement at the end of the 19th century and beginning part of the 20th century is being part of that, trying to clean up politics, trying to clean up baseball, trying to clean up, you know, other civic institutions. I think those two things are sort of fitting together. You know, so if baseball is born during the sort of early part of the Gilded Age as a professional sport, it really tries to clean its act up at the beginning of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, the progressive movement at one level could be interpreted as a sort of, it's anti-corruption, it's trying to improve things, all that kind of thing. We've talked about that many times. It's also kind of a secular Puritan movement as well. completely secular. And the religious history of the country is very interesting in this period, but it's largely secular. But there's a kind of righteousness about it that that culminates maybe, I mean, in the Black Sox scandal. I mean, the fact that comes at the end of the progressive movement, I don't think is a coincidence. Do you want to, I mean, it's the most famous betting scandal, at least until Pete Rose. So
if we're going to think about milestones in this whole thing, I think Black Sox are the big one. So the background to this is that the White Sox from Chicago were favored in the 1919 World Series. They were playing the Cincinnati Reds. About eight players for the White Sox took money from gamblers to throw the World Series. When this was uncovered after the World Series, those eight players were they went on trial first. They were acquitted in the trial for corruption. But then the new commissioner of baseball, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, which is a great name, named after a Civil War battle, decided to ban all eight players for life. And that was in keeping with some traditions that had been set up earlier in the late 19th century and 20th century. But this was sort of the biggest example of players being banned. This includes their Shoeless Joe Jackson, the best player for the White Sox, who actually played pretty well in the World Series. So it's unclear whether he actually did anything to throw it. Some of the other players that did play pretty badly. That is considered one of the big sort of turning points in baseball history. You know, it's after this, they introduced the sort of live baseball that leads to the home run era of Babe Ruth and what have you. And they get rid of the spitball shortly thereafter, which was also seen as being sort of a corrupting influence. There's a real effort to sort of save baseball after this pretty horrendous gambling scandal. The players claimed in part in their defense that the owner of the White Sox, Charles Kaminsky, for whom the stadium was named, didn't pay them very well. And that's part of the reason why they took the money. You want to, I'm sure I'm missing some important bits, Frank.
I think you've hit most of them. I mean, I think two things come from this, which we might consider as we go forward. One is the association of Shoeless Joe Jackson with that scandal and the fact that there are people who to this day, thanks in part to the film Eight Men Out, but I mean, even prior to that, sort of campaign for his innocence, but also say, you know, he deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, and yes. Baseball has a Hall of Fame. One of the consequences of gambling on baseball, if you're convicted of gambling on baseball, is a lifetime ban from baseball and all baseball related activities, and that includes exclusion from baseball's Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. And Shoeless Joe Jackson and the other members of the Black Sox are ineligible for the Hall of Fame. And there's been a kind of movement in the century since to enshrine Jackson in the Hall of Fame. And this will come up with the later, or probably the most notable gambling incident in baseball history, which is concerns Pete Rose of the Cincinnati Reds. We'll get to that in a minute. So there's an association with the Hall of Fame. So there's and a kind of
Hall of Fame didn't exist yet.
No, the Hall of Fame didn't exist then. But the other thing is, after the Black Sox scandal, baseball makes clear, and there's signage in every single locker room in baseball that says, no gambling on baseball. If you gamble on baseball, you're out for life. Yes. And I don't know whether that signage is in Japanese in the Dodgers locker room or was in the Los Angeles Angels locker room for whom Ohtani played before he signed with the Dodgers or not. But this rule is well known in organized baseball, at least in North America, that you're not allowed to gamble on baseball. Because the reason for that is to maintain the integrity of the game. The belief is even if you're betting on your own team, and there's lots of evidence of people betting on their own teams in early baseball history and, frankly, subsequently. Even if you're betting on your own team, you place the integrity of the game at risk. So even if you're betting on your team to win, which maybe is okay, you can't do it. Because the danger is if you start losing money, you could fall into debt and thus be prey to you might be subject to the people you owe money to fix future games. And so gambling on baseball is absolutely forbidden. So these two things, the kind of that absolute rule plus the kind of romance around people who've been associated with gambling, at least after enough time passes, I think is a theme. And the kind of sympathy for people who've been banned. And I think that's a factor. Those are the two things I take away from the
Black Sox. Yeah, yes. So, well, and just thinking about how little the players are making generally at that point is helpful, I think. The highest paid player when the Black Sox scandal happened was Ty Cobb. He was making $20,000 a year, which if you account for inflation is less than the minimum salary for players today. So the best player in the world then was making less than the worst major leaguer does today. The other thing I think that's interesting about that particular moment is, you know, that's also the moment in which you have prohibition being introduced. You're having sort of the rise of organized crime in the United States, and or of a particular kind of organized crime. There have been other organized crime, obviously, before that. But the association between gambling as an illegal activity, illegal alcohol distribution, and, you know, the mafia and various other kinds of organized crime, all those things become woven together starting really in the 1920s. And I think that really reflects there's a movement in baseball after the Black Sox to punish people not only for gambling on baseball, but even associating with gamblers. And there's a couple of examples here I want to throw out, which I think are sort of relevant. In 1947, Leo Durocher, who was the manager of the Dodgers, I think. He was suspended for a year, not for gambling on baseball, but simply for associating with gamblers. In the 70s, Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays were both banned from baseball after they retired. And their crime, supposedly, was that they had been hired as greeters in Atlantic City casinos. Atlantic City was one of the few places in the United States where gambling, casino gambling was legal. And they were hired basically as celebrity greeters. And they were banned, I think, for like 10 years from baseball.
It wasn't quite that long because a new commissioner came in and
took it away.
But they were banned. That's interesting now because one of the things we'll get to, I'm sure, is the kind of mainstreaming of gambling in the United States. So the fact that they were greeters for casinos seems quaint by comparison with what we've seen subsequently. But and it's important for listeners who aren't baseball fans to realize Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays are probably two of the five greatest players who ever lived. And when they were banned, I mean, they were retired, as you know, they were two of the biggest names in the history of the sport at that time. And certainly within living memory, there were people who could remember them playing. So that was huge when they were banned. Just to go back to Leo Durocher, Pee Wee Reese, who played on the Dodgers in 1947 when Durocher was suspended for a year, said, "It seemed like we always had someone hanging around that was a gambler or a bookie." So that, you know, Durocher consorted with some dubious people, but they were around the team, which is why that Durocher was suspended. The interesting thing is, of course, he was brought back. He was suspended for a year, but resumed his career and didn't. I mean, he didn't retire until the early 1970s. He managed a number of teams subsequently. Also, I thought you were going to talk about Denny McClain as well, because in 1970,
I was going to get to him. Yeah, right. Go ahead. You can tell the story.
Well, Denny McClain, who's the last man to win 30 games in 1968, he was a pitcher for the Detroit Tigers. But in 1960, it was alleged that in 1967 that he was heavily involved in gambling, and that a gangster broke his toes, not his fingers, because he was a pitcher, interestingly. And he was suspended in 1970 for this alleged consorting with gamblers and being involved in gambling in 1967.
Now, it wasn't like in that case, it doesn't appear that he was gambling on baseball. It seems like he was gambling on other things, but I think just merely the association with people who gamble, and gambling, I think, is in a very different place, as you point out, in the United States today than it was in the mid 20th century, where it had all these kinds of negative criminal associations with it and people who break your toes when you don't pay your debts and those kinds of things. So let's get to Pete Rose, because I think Pete Rose is the other sort of big, if the Black Sox are one sort of milestone in this, I think the Pete Rose story is the other really big antecedent. Do you want to tell the Pete Rose story, or shall I do the Pete Rose story?
You can tell it, David. Go ahead.
Okay, so Pete Rose was and is the Major League hit leader, so he was an extraordinarily good ball player. You know, he was known for his hustle, you know, for running out every ground ball, and for being somebody who would, you know, crash into the catcher at home plate, and really, you know, tough as nails kind of guy, and played, seemed like, all the positions in the game, you know, as he was needed. By the late 1980s, he's nearing retirement, but he's playing and managing, which was unusual. I mean, it's something that happens occasionally in baseball, but you know, not too often. And he was one of those player managers, and he gets caught gambling on baseball, which he denied at the time, but he has subsequently admitted to. But he appears to have bet on at least 52 games in 1987. And so in 1989, he is banned for life from baseball by baseball commissioner Bart Giamatti. That name sounds familiar to people. He is the father of Paul Giamatti, the actor who just won the Academy Award or whatever it was 2 weeks ago.
What do you want to ask? Yeah, I mean, so a couple of things about Rose. He played for the Cincinnati Reds and the Philadelphia Phillies mainly. He was the all-time hit, or remains the all-time hit king. He bet on baseball. The evidence is pretty compelling, and there was a lengthy investigation carried out by baseball, he got into legal trouble as well. So the law has been involved for various misdeeds of his. He clearly bet on baseball, and he bet on his own team. While he was managing, and I think the fact he was a player manager is interesting and important in this, David, because for two reasons. First of all, it harkens back to the 19th century and early 20th century when player managers were common. They're much less common today. But one of the reasons baseball is, I suppose, attractive to bookies and to casinos is because it's very difficult to bet on. Because it's a very complicated game. There are levels of it's very difficult to predict what's going to happen for the bettor as opposed to the person taking the bet. Except for the one person who can really affect the outcome of a game is the manager. And so the fact that Rose was betting on baseball and betting on his own team while managing that team is important. Because if you really wanted to fix a game, you'd want to get to the manager or a pitcher.
He says, I think the record shows that he only bet on his team to win.
Right.
But some people have said, look, if he only bet on 52 games, he may have done things in the other games differently as a consequence to make sure they won those 52.
That's right. And we get back to the question of the competitive integrity of the game. And Rose has been banned for life. He remains the other thing about Rose that's interesting. You know, Shoeless Joe Jackson, there's a kind of mythos around him, in part because he kind of returned to South Carolina and died, right?
Yeah, and sort of played semi-professional,
and there's a romance around him. There's not much romance around Pete Rose, in part because he's completely unrepentant. I know a guy who used to work at the Hall of Fame who has some very interesting stories to tell about former players he's encountered and who he likes and who he doesn't like, and who's a good guy and who isn't. But Pete Rose is not allowed to enter the Hall of Fame. He turns up at the Hall of Fame every summer, and in Cooperstown, New York, at least every summer, and sells his autograph outside the Hall of Fame. This guy, he'll do anything for a buck. So his nickname, Charlie Hustle, takes on a completely different meaning
exactly.
in his retirement. And this guy said, you know, Pete Rose is a very bad guy. And it's now transpired, and there are credible accusations about him with underage girls and all kinds of, you know, like, Pete Rose has had some, his post-baseball career is not, and his baseball career, frankly, not good, what all we've learned. And all this stuff is a matter of public record. So he's completely unrepentant. When the state of Ohio, where he remains a pretty big celebrity because he played for the Cincinnati Reds, legalized sports gambling, and we'll get to that in a minute. He famously, you know, made the first legal sports bet in Ohio. And so part of this is he's totally unrepentant. He's profiting off this to the extent that he can, his infamy. And Pete Rose remains banned. He has many, many advocates, though, like Shoeless Joe Jackson, who say, look, even if he's a bastard, he still belongs in the Hall of Fame. He's got more than 4,000 hits. He's got more hits than anybody who's ever played baseball. How can you have a Hall of Fame without him?
Yeah.
And so he does have his defenders and advocates.
Yeah. And many of the people who are in the Hall of Fame are have moral lapses of a variety of different kinds that we could elaborate. But it seems that the two things you can't do is you can't bet on baseball and you can't take steroids. But everything else is.
Because these are matters that relate to the competitive integrity of the game.
The game.
So I could even see the logic of saying, look, Ty Cobb, who you mentioned earlier, bad guy. We know he was a racist. We know all kinds of, you know, he seems to have been a bad actor. None of his moral turpitude relates to baseball.
He used to sharpen his spikes to injure.
Right. Okay. All right. But
but you know,
that was also the way the game was played then.
injury infield is part of the game.
But my point being that, you know, there is a distinction to be drawn, or that people draw, between what someone's done in baseball as opposed to outside of baseball. But I can see the logic of that, where, and you're right, but both steroids and betting go to the competitive integrity of the game, which is why why those former players have been excluded. The steroid question is more is messy, but that's not for today.
Although, you know, intriguing, baseball, just based on this record, has always dealt with gambling more forcefully than it ever did with steroids.
Yes, that's right.
You know,
that's
steroids, you get banned, you know, you get a couple of chances to mess up before you have a lifetime ban, whereas gambling, it's a, you know, first transgression, you're out. As a consequence, thinking about sort of putting this in a bigger context, there is a law that gets passed by Congress immediately after, shortly after the Pete Rose scandal, the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, which creates sort of this federal ban on sports gambling, except for, there's a few categories of things that exempts horse racing, dog racing. Do you know what the third one is?
Oh.
High line.
Okay, yeah.
Which is random. I mean, it's a weird law because it has these exemptions for certain things. There's an exemption, for instance, for the state of Nevada. So Nevada always had legal sports gambling, but basically the rest of the country, it says no sports gambling with some weird carve-outs. You know, and I think that was sort of the state of play in the aftermath of the Pete Rose. That was sort of the response to that congressionally. That's in place until 2018 or 2017 when the case goes to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decides in 2018 that the law was unconstitutional based on the 10th Amendment. This is the one of the few times the 10th Amendment actually becomes relevant. But the Supreme Court says basically that Congress doesn't have the authority to regulate gambling in the states. And as a consequence of that, a number of states legalized gambling. And you mentioned, you know, Ohio legalizing gambling. New Jersey was one of the first to really push against this national ban. So right now, I think gambling is legal in more than 30 states. And a lot of people are gambling online. And in fact, lots of gambling and gambling adjacent businesses have become mainstreamed in a way that they weren't, you know, even a few years ago. You know, FanDuel right now is partnered with Major League Baseball. And so there's this very strange scenario where baseball has banned gambling. On the other hand, it's encouraging gambling, and how to sort of square that particular circle, I think, is part of the conundrum we're in right now.
Yeah, I mean, I said this to you before we went on the air, David. You know, I'm living in the U.S. this year. I left in 1992, so I'm a little bit like Rip Van Winkle. And the two biggest changes in the sporting landscape that I observe are the following. First is the total acceptance in the mainstream and the intensity of the passion around European, but particularly British, particularly English soccer. So like it's completely mainstream now in the U.S. You know, it used to be a weird affectation. And it's moved even beyond hipsters now. That's just an observation. The other thing is the mainstreaming of gambling. You know, when I left in 1992, it was the immediate aftermath of the Pete Rose scandal. It's everywhere now. And as you say, FanDuel, DraftKings are heavily involved in both partnering with sports leagues, but also sports media entities. Bally, the casino organization, used to broadcast baseball in a lot of markets until it went until the broadcasting deals collapsed last year. MGM, the MGM casinos, partner with Major League Baseball. This is a very different environment than it was 25, 30 years ago. And gambling, for good or ill, is completely mainstream in the United States now. You know, the two biggest sports leagues in the world, by a considerable margin, are the National Football League in the United States and the Indian Premier League in cricket. And both of those depend on gambling. I mean, and the fervor with which they're followed and is completely tied to gambling. And so gambling and sports, and this is a global phenomenon, are so intimately linked now in a way that makes the earlier bans on gambling and baseball seem quaint and frankly a little weird, you know, and almost incomprehensible. And so I think the Mitsuhara scandal, and I'll call it Mitsuhara rather than Ohtani, because Ohtani has denied all involvement in this so far, it is happening in a very, very different environment. As I said, had Ohtani been playing for the Cincinnati Reds or Cleveland Guardians, and Mitsuhara had been placing legal bets, and Ohtani helped him pay those, I think people would cock an eyebrow, but there would be no kind of legal ramifications to this. The fact it happened in California is an issue here, and the fact that Mitsuhara appears to have placed bets with an illegal bookmaker is a significant issue. But the landscape around gambling is very, very different. I mean, you're returning, you're going to Florida. Yeah. I assume Florida's a free-for-all for all this.
Yeah, no, I think that's the case. I mean, I think a couple of interesting things that have happened that have sort of changed the landscape, besides obviously the Supreme Court decision. One, obviously the internet facilitates gambling on all kinds of levels, right? You don't necessarily need to go to a bookmaker to place a bet, and you can place bets on you know whether the next pitch is going to be a strike or not, right? You can do all that kind of micro.
Spread betting allows you to bet on everything,
so you can bet on all those things, and I think so that's I think one important way in which sort of the gambling has been facilitated. The other I think is fascinating thing, especially for baseball, is the rise of fantasy sports exists in every sport, but it started with baseball, with rotisserie baseball in the early 1980s. And for people wondering why there's a fantasy baseball was named after a chicken dish, it's because it began at a chicken restaurant in New York City, hence rotisserie baseball. But the idea that you could have sort of a statistical analysis and have players and fantasy teams created. I think baseball had that sort of history starting in 1980, and I think it really sort of facilitated this kind of gambling culture that's available now, where you may be interested not in just your home team, but players on other teams and how they are doing on a particular day, even if the games themselves may not matter.
Do you play fantasy baseball, David?
Oh, I played tons of fantasy baseball. I was, I remember playing in middle school. Back when, actually in the 80s, when, you would get you draft the players at the beginning of the season, and you had to, at that point, there weren't any fancy computers to do it. You had to have a service or something that actually added up the numbers for you. Have you done it?
David, I have a team this year.
You have a team this year? Okay. I have not done it since have to resume.
So first of all, and you could easily, and people gamble on fantasy baseball all the time. So if you get into a league with your friends, you each put in $50 and whoever wins the league gets the money at the end. That was the crudest form of it, but you can actually do it on a daily basis through FanDuel and DraftKings. Now I'm not doing that. I'm in a no money league. The major sports news website that I use to create my team allocated me. I'm in a Baltimore area head to head one, I think because of my IP address in Virginia. But I have a strict rule that I never, ever, ever draft New York Yankees because I don't want to root for them under any circumstances. But apart from that, but my first draft pick was Shohei Ohtani.
Ohtani,
and so
oh.
he gets the, so even I'm corrupted because if he gets suspended, which I don't think will happen.
I've been wondering why you've been giving such a positive coverage in this episode, Frank, and really giving him the benefit of the
you
doubt.
See, this
and it's
corrupts
because
everything.
You are corrupted by the no money fantasy league that is you have your honor at stake, and therefore you want to make sure your players.
Yes, with a bunch of strangers in the Baltimore area.
Exactly.
Now, the one thing I'll say is I often lack the patience for this. So even in drafting my team, I had other things to do. So I drafted about four players, starting with Ohtani as my first one. And then because I wasn't responding quickly enough because I was leading my life, yeah. I ended up having auto picks for the rest of my team. So I will end up doing this for about 3 days and then I'll forget I have it and I'll probably lose my login information. But at the moment, so I'm a
irregular
player of fantasy baseball.
Well, it's intriguing about sort of, you know, thinking about the legitimized, you know, gambling becoming sort of mainstreamed in the United States. What kinds of gambling are considered sort of morally upright and legitimate, and what kinds aren't? So doing fantasy baseball with your friends for $50 or for honor or whatever it is, that's usually considered fine. If you do it, you know, Friday night, poker night with the buddies, that's considered fine. You know, betting on the NCAA basketball tournament and you throw in your bracket, you know, for your office pool, that's considered fine. Going spending $1,000 betting on horses seems a bit sketchy. And I was curious about sort of how the sort of moral landscape of gambling has evolved and what's considered, kosher, and in some ways is even sort of upright part of what communities do, like betting on the basketball tournament versus what's considered problematic and what's considered sort of illicit.
I think that's really interesting. And I think I'm not qualified to write the history of this, but I think it'll be a really interesting history because there's certainly been a changing attitude towards betting, as I say, in the past 30, 35 years. Interestingly, because we live in the UK, or I'm returning, you're leaving, but, you know, it's always been a much bigger part of the sporting culture in the UK and more acceptable. Although, again, players are not meant to bet on soccer. You know, footballers are not meant to bet on football and cricketers aren't meant to bet on cricket, et cetera. Although both of those sports have had notable scandals over the years. There's a very good subplot in Peaky Blinders for those who've watched it about when they start fixing football matches in the late 20s and early 30s. In that fictional universe, I should say. But it's always been, and betting shops, you know, are widespread and legal in the UK and have been for a very, very long time. So the cultures are different. But one thing that's really interesting, I think it's the internet and smartphones, among other things, have made it much easier for people to bet. You can just do it, and you can do spread betting. You can bet in a soccer game on how many corner kicks there are going to be or whatever during the match, while you're in the stadium. And similarly, the same technology makes betting on baseball or cricket or whatever your sport is, basketball, much easier, which makes it almost impossible to regulate.
Yes, I think that's right.
You know, and so I think this landscape, it also, it's different now than when, you know, it was illegal and therefore you had to place a bet with a bookie who was associated with the mafia.
Yeah.
Now, whether these entities, these major transnational entities that profit off gambling are better than the mafia or not, I think I'll leave to others to judge. But
without
but
breaking
different
anybody's toes, as far as I'm aware. But
I don't know.
Metaphorically breaking people's toes, maybe.
Who knows? Who knows? But technology has made it much, much easier. So I don't think it's going away. And I just really hope that Shohei Ohtani plays today because I need his points for my fantasy team. Against anonymous people in the Baltimore, in the Maryland, Virginia area that I'm playing against.
So, listeners, if you happen to be in the same fantasy league as Frank, you may have different impulses for how this plays out. Right. Time for last drops, Frank. What you got?
David, I want to acknowledge the passing of Dr. Daniel P. Jordan. Dan Jordan was the president of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation from the mid 1980s until the early aughts. I knew Dan a little bit. He passed away last week. Dan was the historian who came from Mississippi. He did his PhD at the University of Virginia under Merrill Peterson. He was a scholar of Jefferson. He taught at Virginia Commonwealth University for a little while before he became the president of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, which runs Monticello as a museum. Dan was the president of Monticello in the late 90s, right after Annette Gordon-Reed wrote her first book, in which she examined the evidence about the Sally Hemings-Thomas Jefferson relationship. And then the next year, after that book came out, it's really the timing here is important. The next year, the DNA testing was conducted and the results were published in Nature, which showed that a male Jefferson relative was the father of Sally Hemings's last child. And the Annette's book plus that DNA study really presented Monticello with a challenge because, frankly, Monticello and the people around Monticello had for decades denied the Sally Hemings relationship. And many people, they weren't alone in this, I want to stress. That was the kind of orthodoxy in the historiography. Lots of people denied it. And faced with both Annette's book and the DNA test results, and then some subsequent evidence, Fraser Nyman's study about where Jefferson, his kind of Jefferson's presence relative to Hemings's conceptions. Dan Jordan created a commission to examine all this evidence. It was a scholarly commission made up of a number of scholars with expertise across the various disciplines relating to this question. Dan himself was uncomfortable with this question. Yet he was a scholar and a leader. And when the commission came back and said, yep, we believe on balance that this is true, the foundation at Dan's behest accepted and changed its formal position on the relationship between Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. And that was the kind of leader Dan Jordan was. He was also just an extremely nice man. I was talking to colleagues here over the past few days since Dan's death, and a senior member of the foundation said to me, who never met Dan, said, I have not heard one person say a negative thing about him. And he was really, truly beloved. And I didn't know him that well. I knew him a little bit. And he had me up for lunch when I was working on my first book on Jefferson. He was a very simple guy, had very simple taste. He'd sort of have kind of egg salad and Coke and a bag of chips. That was lunch. You know, he wasn't up for fancy lunches. I met him with some frequency, with some regularity rather than frequency is a better way to put it. But he was always just incredibly nice and interested in what I was doing. And he was interested in everybody. He always asked how your family was, that kind of thing. He had a beautiful, beautiful Mississippi accent. I mean, I wouldn't try to impersonate it, but yeah, kind of very, you know, beautiful way of speaking. And I saw him last a couple of months ago, you know, and while I've been here, he came to see me and was really encouraging and talked about the future of the International Center for Jefferson Studies and what I might do and this and that. And he always, you know, he loved the one thing he would have whenever he visited. He said, "Do you have a cold Coke?" And so he'd always have a Coke. And so whenever I knew he was coming, I'd always make sure there was Coke in the fridge at the International Center for him. So just, you know, it's the end of an era. He was in his mid 80s. He'd been in failing health in recent months, and just want to acknowledge the passing of Dan Jordan, who was a important figure in the history of Monticello, made a really important contribution to Jefferson studies over his career.
Yes.
So what about you, David?
Oh, I should say Ty Cobb, who we mentioned earlier, early investor in Coke and made millions off of it.
Okay.
Now, there's a connection for everything. Anyway, I want to mention a book I'm excited about. I haven't gotten a copy of it yet because it's not yet available in the UK, but that's Manisha Sinha's book, The Rise and Fall of the Second American Republic, Reconstruction 1860 to 1920, which is a long framework for reconstruction. This is a big book. This is her second big book in a row. Her last book on the abolitionist movement is tome, I think is the right word for it. And this looks like to be another one of those. And I'm haven't gotten it yet, but I think I'm going to get it. I'm going to be in Connecticut in a week and a bit, and she teaches in Connecticut, so I think I might have to pick up a copy when I am there. But congratulations to her on this important new book.
Yeah, it's going to be a really important book, I think.
Yes. Great. Until next week, Frank. Cheers.
Okay, David. Bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.